Hello, and welcome to Medic in the Middle. Hello, and welcome back to the latest installment of Medic in the Middle. Medic in the Middle is a podcast series which aims to delve into a range of topics, issues and articles around pre-hospital medicine and the pre-hospital environment. It's hosted by myself, registered paramedic Tom Alderson. This latest episode is going to be on asthma. I ran a asthma CPD event within my own organisation last year, and I thought it'd be really cool just to have a chat about it on this format, and so that the listeners amongst you can just get a chance to listen to some of the content that we talked about, as well as getting the opportunity to listen to some of the extended pharmacodynamics and pharmacology that we're going to cover in today's podcast as well. So without any further ado, let's get to it. Asthma is a really common complaint in the pre-hospital environment. It's estimated that 5.4 million people in the UK are currently receiving treatment for asthma, and that 1.1 million children, that's almost 1 in 11 children, and 1 in 12 adults are receiving treatment for asthma of some kind. It's estimated that every 10 seconds somebody is having potentially a life-threatening asthma attack in the UK. And on average, it's said that 3 people die from asthma in the UK every day. So it really is a topic that as pre-hospital clinicians we need to be familiar with. So today we're going to be looking at the pathophysiology of asthma, the management of asthma, and the pharmacodynamics of some of the medications involved in treating asthma. A good place to start, I think, is always a definition. So we'll just jump straight in with a definition of asthma. So asthma is a syndrome characterized by variable reversible airway obstruction and abnormal sensitivity of the airways to various stimuli. Symptoms can include wheezing, chest tightness, dyspnea, and or cough. It's associated with widespread contraction of bronchial smooth muscle, known as bronchoconstriction, hypersecretion of mucus, and mucosal edema, all of which narrow the airways, resulting in airflow obstruction, which may be chronic or episodic, with respiratory symptoms resolving either spontaneously or as a result of therapy. So that may be bronchodilators or corticosteroids. A generally accepted definition of asthma does not yet really actually exist, and there hasn't been a consensus on a widely accepted definition, because a syndrome has so many different causes, mechanisms and clinical features and responses to therapy. But that what I've just said kind of just sums it up in a roundabout way. Now, there's two kinds of asthma, essentially. One is known as intrinsic asthma and the other is known as extrinsic asthma. Intrinsic asthma may have a range of triggers, including weather conditions, exercise, infections and stress. It's otherwise known as non-allergic asthma. So with this, we get the breakdown of cell membranes. So the phospholipid bilayer of the cell wall is hydrolyzed or broken down in the presence of water by something called phospholipase A2. The defining enzymic function of phospholipase A2 is the cleavage of membrane phospholipids into smaller bioactive molecules that then participate in a plethora of cellular processes. But I'll try and break it down as simple as I can. So we get this breakdown of the cell membrane wall in an episode of intrinsic asthma or infection or stress or any other kind of intrinsic process going on. So the cell wall is broken down by something called, as I mentioned, phospholipase A2. And this releases something called arachidonic acid, which is essentially a molecule a molecule that's associated with messaging, so it's a messenger molecule. And from that, we get lipooxygenase and cyclooxygenase. These two further break down then into, we get leukotrienes from lipooxygenase. And this is responsible for bronchial constriction and increased vessel permeability. From cyclooxygenase, we get what's known as COX-1 and COX-2. So we get thromboxanes and prostaglandins. Thromboxanes are associated with the mucosal lining of the GI tract. They're also associated with platelet aggregation, whereas prostaglandins are more commonly associated with inflammation or pain. And we'll come on to how these kind of link in with the management of this condition in a short while. So next we'll look at extrinsic asthma. So extrinsic asthma, these symptoms are developed by an allergen or triggered by an allergen. It's sometimes known as like the allergic response asthma. So things such as dust mites, pets, pollen or mold. The immune system essentially overreacts, producing too much of a substance called IgE. So immunoglobulin E are antibodies that are produced by the immune system. If you have an allergy, your immune system overreacts to an allergen by producing antibodies, in this case called immunoglobulin E or IgE. And these antibodies travel to the cells that then release chemicals causing an allergic reaction, put simply. There are actually five different types of classes of immunoglobulins. There's IgG, IgM, IgA, IgD and IgE. And they all form various different roles as part of the immune response. So an antigen or allergen binds with immunoglobulin in the lining of the respiratory mucosa. This causes histamine, kinins, prostaglandins and other chemical mediators to be released. Histamine binds to histamine 1 receptors and this causes edema, inflammation and increased mucus production. We also get quite leaky blood vessels associated with vasodilation, which can lead to fluid loss within the interstitial spaces. So I think we should look at the physiological changes that occur in the body during an asthmatic insult. So the body essentially gets an overstimulation of the vagus nerve through excessive coughing, which causes a reflex bronchoconstriction and a bronchospasm. Air then becomes trapped as a result of this, and so forced expiration often causes bronchial collapse. We then get a residual volume that increases, and this makes it quite difficult to cough, so mucus can't be expelled. We might also have to at this point consider arrhythmias that are occurring on the patient's ECG. We also can get some CNS depression as well, so just keeping a really close eye on that patient's GCS and looking out for any potential drop in their GCS level. So once the airways become totally obstructed with mucus plugging, this leads to atelectasis beyond the obstruction itself. So we get alveolar collapse. Hypoxia is induced as air cannot diffuse through these affected areas. Respiratory muscle activity increases as the demand for the O2 increases. So we get metabolic and respiratory acidosis that can occur. Hypoxemia causes vasoconstriction in the pulmonary vessels, compounding the problem, and this also increases the workload of the right side of the heart as well. We get increased leukocytes, so white blood cells, particularly xenophils, which are responsible for combating multicellular parasites and certain infections. We get a release of additional chemical mediators as well, such as leukotrienes, as we mentioned earlier, from the release of lipoxygenase. This causes prolonged inflammation and prolonged bronchoconstriction and tissue damage. Histamine causes an increased blood vessel permeability as well. So blood leaks out of the tissues, causing swelling or edema or angioedema as well. So some of you may be wondering, why not treat these acute inflammations or acute attacks with antihistamines? And really, bronchospasm is related to histamine. Well, bronchospasm that's related to histamine alone is quite uncommon. So true allergy or antigen antibody IgE responses result in the release of a host of mediators from the mast cells and circulating basophils. And only one of these happens to be histamine. So a first generation H1RA or histamine 1 receptor site antagonist, such as chlorpheniramine, which we carry in my service anyway, can have CNS effects, and certainly would have CNS effects with the dose required to combat this kind of gigantic histamine response anyway. The dose would have to be too high to combat that due to the competitive immune response, so you would be seeing CNS depressant with the amount of doses it required to combat that. In severe persistent asthma, this is from the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma and Immunology. So in severe persistent asthma, histamine 1 antihistamines, they said, should not be expected to confer significant benefits. So initial management and treatment of these patients then. We want to be undertaking a good primary survey, so with an A, B, C, D, E approach. We want to be paying close attention to heart rates, respiratory rates and SATs, as these are going to be useful in sort of having a rough ballpark guess at where these patients are at first glance in the categories of asthma. So it's kind of undertaking almost like an end of bedogram, I suppose. We're going to just be looking at these patients, you know, do they look exhausted? Have they got a respiratory rate that's obviously above 25 breaths a minute? Do they look cyanosed? You know, are they making poor respiratory effort? Those kind of things just that we can be looking out for as part of our initial assessment to try and gauge what sort of management these patients are going to need. It's not always practical or pragmatic to be looking at peak flows if your patient is obviously exhausted and cannot complete sentences. You know, their SATs are way below where they need to be. It's not going to be pragmatic to start getting that patient who is already gasping for breath to try and breathe through one of our peak flow meters. So let's talk a little bit about what we're going to be hearing on auscultation of these patients and their chests. So wheezes are heard quite commonly during asthmatic attacks. Wheezes are heard more commonly during expiration because the airway is normally narrow during this phase of respiration on the patient's outbreath. Wheezing during expiration alone is generally indicative of a milder obstruction than if it presents during both inspiration and expiration. If we get wheezing on inspiration, this can suggest a more severe airway narrowing. I just want to go over with you guys the four different classifications of asthma from the British Thoracic Society. So the British Thoracic Society have four stages of asthma, which was updated, to the best of my knowledge, in 2019. They range from moderate acute asthma to near fatal asthma. So it goes from moderate acute, acute to severe, life-threatening, and near fatal. So the way these are broken down, we'll quickly just run through it. You're a moderate acute asthmas. So this is increasing symptoms. They might have a peak expiratory flow of 50 to 75% of their best or predicted, and they have no features of acute severe. Acute severe, I think, is probably the one that we see most commonly presenting to us in the pre-hospital environment. Certainly where I work anyway, these are the kind of patients that we tend to come across the most. So they might have any one of these criteria. So they might have a peak expiratory flow of 33 to 50% best or predicted. They'll have an increased respiratory rate, so it might be more than or equal to 25 breaths a minute. Their heart rate is going to be more than or equal to 110 beats a minute. And they're not going to be able to complete sentences with one breath. So they're going to be just struggling a little bit to complete their sentences. The next one, so category three, is life-threatening asthma. So for life-threatening asthma, essentially, they need to be already in the acute severe category and then have any one of the following presentations on top of that. So that might be altered consciousness level or altered GCS level, as we talked about with CNS depression that can occur. Exhaustion is one. We mentioned earlier they might start to have cardiac arrhythmias, be also hypotensive. They could have cyanosis. They may have a silent chest. In terms of measurements, these patients are going to have a peak expiratory flow of less than 33% best or predicted. Their SpO2 is going to be below 92%. They're also going to have altered arterial blood gases, so they might have a partial pressure of oxygen lower than 8 kilopascals. Now, the normal would be between 4.6 to 6, state the BTS guidelines. And the next last category is near fatal asthma. So they're going to have raised partial pressures of carbon dioxide, and they're going to be requiring mechanical ventilation with raised inflation pressures as well. Management wise, so we're going to move on to gel calcs, drugs for management. So in the pre-hospital environment, that first line of treatment is going to be salbutamol. So salbutamol is a short-acting selective beta-2 adrenergic receptor agonist. That's quite a mouthful. So beta-2 adrenergic agonists are a large group of drugs that mimic the actions of naturally occurring catecholamines such as norepinephrine, epinephrine and dopamine. Salbutamol acts as a functional agonist, binding to beta-2 receptor sites in the smooth muscle lining the airways, which then help them to open up and relax, thus combating the bronchospasm that's involved in asthmatic responses. It's 29 times more selective for beta-2 receptors than beta-1 receptors, giving it a higher specificity for pulmonary beta receptors versus beta-1 adrenergic receptors that are located in the heart. However, being that it does have a weak affinity for beta-1 receptors in the heart, we're going to see side effects such as tachycardia and increased irritability and anxiety to some extent in these patients with repeated doses. So it's just worth bearing that in mind, weighing up the pros and cons of repeated doses of salbutamol in these patients. Right, okay, cool. So a measurable decrease in airway resistance is typically observed within 5 to 15 minutes after inhalation of salbutamol. The maximum improvement in pulmonary function occurs about 60 to 90 minutes after salbutamol treatment, and significant bronchodilatory activity has been observed to persist for 3 to 6 hours. But initially, we're going to see that relief from the patient's respiratory symptoms within 5 to 15 minutes. So I think we should talk a little bit about metered dose inhalers. So particularly with paediatric patients who are struggling with asthma, salbutamol via their own metered dose inhalers is preferred over nebulized therapy unless they are hypoxic or non-compliant. With metered dose inhalers, the old saying goes, you know, one puff, 10 breaths, up to 10 times. Certainly where I work, metered dose inhalers are recommended over nebulizer therapy for adults and children who are suffering from mild to moderate asthma. There has been some research done into the use of metered dose inhalers, which we shall go over now. So Sanchez et al. 2016 states that more than two-thirds of people don't have the proper technique for metered dose inhalers, and that even with optimal technique, prescribed metered dose inhalers can only deliver at best 20% of an inhaled drug. The addition of a spacer device or valve holding chamber to a metered dose inhaler is said to improve medication delivery to the airways, and that's McIver et al. 2018. Contrary to Sanchez 2016, there have been studies that show emergency use in the context of an exacerbation of disease such as asthma or COPD. The use of a metered dose inhaler with a valve holding chamber is at least as effective as nebulized therapy. And that comes from a study from Cates et al. 2013 and Van Gijven et al. 2016. NICE 2019 guidelines state that the choice of delivery should reflect the dose of drug required and the ability of the individual to use the device effectively. The next drug we're going to look at as part of our management of these patients is Atrovent or ipratropium bromide. So Atrovent is an anticholinergic or an antimuscarinic medication. So that just means it acts to suppress the parasympathetic response. The airways are quite closely linked to the autonomic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. So the parasympathetic response, we get constriction of the airways, and in the sympathetic response, we get the dilation, which is what we mentioned previously with salbutamol, kind of mimicking those medications such as epinephrine and adrenaline. Ipratropium acts as an antagonist of the muscarinic acetylcholine receptor. So this effect produces the inhibition of the parasympathetic nervous system in the airways and hence inhibits their function. The function of parasympathetic systems in the airway is to generate bronchial secretions and constriction. Hence, the inhibition of this action leads to bronchodilation and fewer secretions. At a cellular level, the diameter of the airways is controlled by the release of acetylcholine into the muscle cells, causing them to contract and produce a narrow airway. Thus, administration of ipratropium stops the activity of acetylcholine in the smooth muscle, preventing the contraction and producing sort of more relaxed airways. The onset of action of this drug that we're going to give via a nebulizer is less than 15 minutes. Peak effect tends to be about 1 to 2 hours, with duration tend to last about 4 to 6 hours. The GRCalc dosage for this drug is 500 micrograms in 2 mL, and that's to be given by a nebulizer at 6 to 8 liters a minute with no repeated doses. That dose is for adults. It's worth just consulting your GRCalc for pediatric doses, as it does change and it does differ. Moving on now to our non-inhaled agents that we use to treat asthma in the pre-hospital environment. We are looking at hydrocortisone, so our corticosteroids. It's indicated for treatment severe to life-threatening asthma. So cortisol is an endogenous hormone. It's produced by the adrenal gland, and its role in the body is mainly blood sugar regulation, immune response or inflammatory processes. It's involved in a stress response, so it encourages gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis, so it increases our stores and our availability of energy in the body. It also increases the amount of glucagon, so therefore makes energy more readily available. Hydrocortisone binds to the glucocorticoid receptor, which is found in most of the cells in the body. Lipocortin synthesis and release is regulated by corticosteroids or cortisol. And lipocortin is actually an inhibitor of phospholipase A2. Which, if you remember from earlier, is what aids the breakdown of, hydrolyzes a cell membrane. So by inhibition of phospholipase A2, you get a reduced formation of arachidonic acid and the other metabolites that we talked about, such as your leukotrienes and your thromboxanes and pro-inflammatory mediators like prostaglandins, etc. Another point that's worth mentioning, just being aware of, is that corticosteroids are actually associated with upregulation of beta-2 adrenergic receptor function. So this is going to be really useful when it comes to treating these patients with our drugs such as salbutamol, our beta-2 agonists. Just a little bit more about cortisol production in the body and how it's regulated. So endogenous cortisol production by the adrenal gland is controlled by the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which occurs in diurnal and circadian patterns every 24 hours. So essentially, cortisol levels naturally drop in the body in the early hours of the morning to facilitate rest and sleep. So bear in mind, discharging these patients on scene, these asthma patients on scene in the early hours of the morning after an episode of an asthma attack, it's something just to bear in mind that, you know, because of these low cortisol levels in the middle of the night, it may lead to repeat episodes after you've discharged the patient, or that, you know, that patient's condition can worsen due to low levels of cortisol circulating in the body. So just have an appropriate safety net in for the patient if you are going to be discharging in the early hours of the morning is just really important. Now moving on to our last drug in the asthma algorithm treatment, which is for life-threatening asthma. So we move on to IM adrenaline. So its common presentation is going to be 1 milligram in a 1 mL ampoule. The adult dose is 500 micrograms, so it's half of that 1 mL syringe. The treatment of life-threatening asthma using sort of ADM or IM adrenaline is part of the UK ambulance guidance. It's not actually included in the BTS or the British Thoracic Society guidelines for life-threatening asthma, which is why there sometimes I think can be a bit of confusion when we're bringing in these patients into the hospital environment and we explain that we're given IM adrenaline. If then, you know, in hospital practitioners are not familiar with the GRCAUT guidelines and the pre-hospital treatment, there can sometimes be a little bit of confusion. So it's a mainstay treatment in GRCAUT for life-threatening asthma, and it's mainly for treatment of, you know, reversing the bronchospasm involved with anaphylaxis or the antigen allergen response. Benz's anaphylaxis is, you know, it's a fairly big differential for us in the pre-hospital environment if we have a patient with a silent chest who is cyanosed, who has sats of less than 92%, who is exhausted with a reduced GCS. You know, it's quite difficult, I think, sometimes in certain contexts to tell the difference between what is an asthma attack that's been triggered by an allergen response or an anaphylactic response. Hence, it remains the mainstay treatment for life-threatening asthma within the GRCAUT guidance. So IM adrenaline acts as a alpha and beta adrenergic receptor agonist. So through its action on alpha adrenergic receptors, it minimalizes the vasodilation that occurs and acts to reduce the increased vascular permeability that occurs within the vasculature during these antigen allergen responses. Without correction of which can lead to the patient becoming hypotensive due to the loss of intravascular fluid volume into the interstitial spaces, which occurs because the vessels become quite leaky. Epinephrine also relaxes a smooth muscle of the bronchi. It also helps act as a histamine antagonist, which renders it quite useful in treating the manifestations of allergic reactions and associated conditions such as anaphylaxis, which would be our differential within these patients. Through its action on beta adrenergic receptors, adrenaline also leads to the bronchial smooth muscle relaxation, and that helps to relieve bronchospasm, wheezing and dyspnea, or other respiratory symptoms that we're going to be seeing in these patients. Moving on now to cardiac arrest and changes that we need to consider for these patients in cardiac arrest scenarios. So currently in-line nebulization has been removed from the cardiac arrest management. So this is due to concerns over hyperinflation causing barotrauma. There's a risk that we may actually give these patients a pneumothorax if we overventilate them with either too much pressure or too much volume. Chest compressions may also have the potential to be less effective in this cohort of patients as well, due to the increased intrathoracic pressures they're going to have from breath stacking or raised intrinsic PEEP, which we'll get onto shortly. To delve into the increases in intrathoracic volumes a little bit, I think we should just talk about the natural physiology that occurs in the lungs during a normal cycle of respiration. So during inspiration, the increased volume of the alveoli as a result of lung expansion decreases the intraalveoli pressure to a value below atmospheric pressure, about -1 centimeters of H2O, centimeters of water. So this slight negative pressure that we get in the lungs is enough to move 500 mils roughly of air into the lungs in about 2 seconds required for normal inspiration. During expiration, the opposite changes occur, so the lung alveoli collapse before air is expelled from them. The alveoli pressure rises then to about plus 1 centimeter of H2O, centimeters of water. So this forces the 500 mils of inspired air out of the lung during expiration, which normally occurs over about 2 or 3 seconds. And by the end of that expiration, the pressure drops gradually to become atmospheric again. In patients with asthma or COPD, patients have higher levels of intrinsic PEEP. So it can be, you know, for an example, about 14 centimeters of H2O or 14 centimeters of water. So, which is why they're susceptible to dynamic hyperinflation or breath stacking from incomplete exhalations. So intrinsic PEEP occurs when the expiratory time is shorter than the time needed to fully deflate the lungs, preventing the lung and chest wall from reaching an elastic equilibrium point. Other things to be aware of in these patients in cardiac arrest. So eye gels, when we're looking at airway management and advanced airway management. So an eye gel is probably not going to be as effective due to increased airway pressures, and they tend to be quite high in these patients. So we may need to consider an ET tube. We might need to consider intubating these patients, or, you know, if that in a pre-hospital setting is available to you, you might just want to think about early request of an advanced clinician, whether that be a paramedic or a critical care paramedic, just a care provider that is able to intubate patients. You might just think about early request of those if they aren't already on scene and those resources aren't already available to you. These patients, you know, tension pneumothorax in these patients, so think about the 4 H's and the 4 T's, the likelihood of a tension pneumothorax in these patients is going to be quite high, as we previously mentioned, due to increased pressures. These patients are also going to be quite hypovolemic potentially due to extended periods of hypoxia. So increased intrathoracic pressures is going to have a direct effect on that patient's systemic venous return. And they're also going to have higher pressures in their pulmonary arteries, and afterload is also going to be increased in these patients potentially if they have got quite significantly increased intrathoracic pressures. In some cases, if the clinician feels comfortable and it is within their scope of practice, they may want to consider manual deflation of the chest wall. That's it for this episode of Medic in the Middle. I hope you've enjoyed it. So to summarise, we have covered asthma and its definition, we've covered its presentation, how to manage it and some of the pharmacodynamics behind the drugs that we use to treat this condition. We've also covered asthma's pathophysiology and how to manage cardiac arrest scenarios. So I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Please do stay tuned with the show for more episodes to come. Stay safe and speak to you soon.